Life exists all around us in forms that we can readily and easily identify, but what if there were other not-so-familiar forms of life lurking in the corners, in the shadows, creatures not created by nature, but by people? We know their names, don't we? Frankenstein, the Golem, and so many more. Up next, Dr. Bob Curran joins us as we talk about man-made monsters on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Here's a Coast to Coast favorite, Dr. Bob Curran, born in a remote area in Northern Ireland. I sometimes think with leprechauns. At the age of 14, he left school. He became a grave digger, eventually worked at a number of jobs, including professional rock musician, a journalist. He attended university where he took his doctorate, earned also several degrees, became a teacher, and he's the author of almost 50 books on folklore and history, and acts as an advisor to several Northern Ireland governmental bodies on culture, education, and here he is. Hey, Bob, happy holidays to you, my friend.
On to you too, George. You're beginning to make me even sound interesting. So good for you. It's great to be back with you again.
Likewise. Hey, what is going on, by the way, in the United Kingdom? They were chasing the prince.
Indeed. Now, I was doing a set of interviews last night and didn't see a lot of the coverage of it. But apparently they were throwing stuff at the prince's car. They're raising fees for students at the moment because of this recession that's on here. And a lot of people are not very happy about it because a part of our ruling coalition government promised that they would stand against raising fees for students. They're raising them from £3,000 to £9,000 per year. Which is a lot of money for many middle-class families. So a lot of students and a lot of people are not happy about it. And as a father of children who are almost ready to go to university, I'm a bit worried about it myself.
Well, you know what? I think they took it a little far out there calling for their heads, don't you?
I think so. Although back in history, they have decapitated at least one monarch, Charles I. They cut off his head in 1649. Jeez. So they're shouting for the heads and they're shouting for the government to be brought down. But we'll see what happens. It is interesting times, George.
Yeah, it just tells you just the shape of things right now, Bob. And funny story about a good month ago, as I was making my way towards St. Louis, I dropped off in Las Vegas for a weekend, and I'm playing blackjack. And there's a woman there who's got severe breast cancer. I mean, they were giving her maybe a month or 2 months, so she's there having a good time, and as good a time as you can with that. And she was under heavy chemotherapy. And we started talking, and she's from Ireland, and you know, she lives in Santa Barbara in Ireland. And I mentioned you; she's heard of your name before, so you've got a big name out there. And you know, I started talking to her about some holistic things, and I said, "Look, I want you to think I'm strange, but give me your address. I'm going to send you some things." And so I sent her some pH boosters and some things to put in water and stuff like that, and turmeric. And I said, I just want you to test your pH level. I am convinced that your acidic level is way, way down, which your alkaline level's down, your acidic level is high. So when you take a pH test, if you have a level of 7, 7.3, you're normal. That's good. Cancer lives in an acidic body, which is under 7. And, you know, the lower you go, the worse it is. And I said, boy, I bet you're around 5 or so. So she sends me an email today, and she said, George, my God, you're right. My level is about 4. And so I said, take what I sent you, talk to your doctor, and boost that level. But here's a woman from Ireland who's heard of you that I run into on a whim. And you know what? Maybe we can help her out, Bob. That's what it's all about, you know?
That's exactly what it's all about, George. It's about helping people and not worrying almost about money. I mean, you can't do away with the worry about money, but it's about helping people and trying to be selfless, George.
Absolutely. Now, let's talk about the new work, Man-Made Monsters. We're going to have fun with this tonight. How do you define the term man-made monster?
Well, it can be defined in a number of ways. We're talking about Frankenstein. We're talking about the golem. But in a sense, we have to look at the term monster, which comes from the word monstrum, which means something which is very unusual. And we almost, if you like, create our own monsters. So we can look at it in a psychological sense. We take the notion of Frankenstein. Frankenstein, we must remember, was not the name of the monster. It was the name of his creator, Victor Frankenstein. And that is significant because in many ways, it is Frankenstein himself who turns him into the monster. The monster is a bit of a template on which Frankenstein writes his own fears and his own prejudices and things like that, and turns him into the monster. So the term man-made monster may be something which is created, and we can talk about that and the sort of duality of the creature. But it is also a psychological thing because we, in many respects, we create our own monsters in our mind. And the monsters may serve as a sort of symbol for something. The worst monsters which we can face are the monsters which lurk in the dark recesses of our mind. So those are also man-made. So the term man-made monsters are how people have viewed the monster and the legends which have grown up around it.
And these monsters have been created since when? The beginning of time? I mean, they go way, way back, don't they?
Well, you have all sorts of monsters. And whenever we were looking at the book, we had to whittle down an immense amount of material because I kept saying to the publishers, can we include this? Can we include that? And they said, no, we only have about 200 pages because we could have produced a book almost twice the size. Monsters have existed in the minds and served as metaphors for many prejudices and fears. For example, one of the monsters which we could have dealt with, and we didn't, and this may be in another book at some other time, is, let's say, the Minotaur, the son of King Minos of Crete, who was supposed to be half man, half animal. He had the head of a bull and a fearsome strength, and lived in the labyrinth, and was killed by Theseus. Now, was that an actual monster, or was that, let's say, a deformed son, or was it a sort of a metaphor for the war which was going on between the city-state of Athens and this, the Minoan Empire based in Crete? Way back in BC. The notion of the Minotaur created fear within the Athenians and showed that the Minoans or the Cretans were incredibly barbarous and they served as a pagan symbol. So we have been creating monsters in our minds since early times. The time when Frankenstein appeared in the early 1800s was an interesting time because at that time, and this is another thing which the book tried to do, because I have written an awful lot about what we might call superstition or right. What we might call folklore, but this at this period, what we might term superstition was fading out. It was a sort of transitionary time, and what we now might refer to as hard science was coming in. You're between a sort of superstitious age and a scientific age. And Frankenstein, I think, reflects that. And the book itself reflects that. The transition between the supernatural and the scientific, as men struggled with that, to try and rationalize many of the beliefs which they had held during the 14th, 15th, 16th, and 17th centuries. As the 18th century came and the 19th century after, men struggled to do away with the sort of superstition and supernatural interpretations of the world, and began to look at the hard scientific. And today we have taken scientific to another level. We tend to frame up our world in scientific terms. But the time of when Frankenstein was written in the early 1800s, there was a transitionary period, and people were struggling with that. So once again, the man-made monsters comes into play.
And when Mary Shelley wrote the story of Frankenstein, did she know or hear of a Dr. Frankenstein?
Yes. George Frankenstein is an actual name. There were the Counts of Frankenstein. But I don't think it really was the Frankensteins, because there was the famous Johann Conrad Dippel, who had been actually born at Castle Frankenstein on the Rhine. There actually is a Castle Frankenstein, which we know that Mary Shelley visited. And Dippel was more of a theologian, although he experimented in early chemistry and produced a thing which was known as Dippel oil, which was taken from the ground-up bones of animals. It was supposed to increase life, but it was actually the basis of a dye, the Berliner blue, a famous blue dye. But the man who I think Mary Shelley based Victor Frankenstein on was a gentleman called Giovanni Aldini. Now, without going into an awful lot, because there's a lot in the book about him, Aldini had very, very interesting scientific views. He was an Italian. And he was the nephew of an even more famous Italian, a man called Luigi Galvini. Now, Galvini had this notion that the body was powered by some form of electricity produced naturally within the body.
He might have been right about that.
He may well have been. And he believed, it was called galvanic electricity, and he believed that a body which had been dead for a time could be kick-started again, sort of, so to speak, and brought back to life. Now, this was at a very interesting time, because much of Western Europe was devastated by war. Two big protagonists at the time were England and France. And the theater of conflict was mainly on the ocean, because both were seafaring countries.
Right.
And many sailors drowned in naval engagements, and their bodies were still intact. They weren't blown to pieces or anything. Some of them had naturally drowned. So there was an idea about, which fitted in with Galvini's idea, that a body could be brought back to life intact and put back into the conflict. A sailor could be, let's say, had been drowned and could be revivified, as they said, and actually would become a serving soldier, sailor again. And this interested the Admiralty. So this is what both Galvini and Aldini were interested in.
You know, it's interesting. They've got a research piece of machinery that they used to use during television in the old days to test audiences about a program or about a television anchor person. And they call it the galvanic skin response.
That's right. Because Galvani experimented with frogs and various other animals. I think he also worked on a dog. But he certainly worked with frogs and put in skin responses and was able to make the frogs leap with an electric shock. So why not, said Galvani and Aldini, because it was Aldini who actually came to London to interest the Navy in his experiments. The English naval authorities. So why not attempt this on a dead body, which could be reanimated? Now, to some extent, George, we do exactly the same today, because you will see on most of the medical programs or many of the medical dramas in which a person whose heart has stopped and, as we say, gone into VF.
Yep, they shock him back.
We shock him. That's right. We put the two paddles on him and shock him. But these are people who are, whose heart has simply stalled, or who are have just gone into death, if you like, or stopped, and there is still some semblance of life there. Galvani argued that it could cadaver, which had been dead for maybe a fairly short time. You needed a fresh body to do that, or else rigor mortis would set in and things like that. But
and that sets in within hours, doesn't it, Bob?
Sorry?
Doesn't it set in within hours?
Oh, it sets in within hours. And yeah. He had thought that you could give him maybe an hour or a couple of hours and then restart the body again. The famous Dr. Henry Klein, who was actually the physician to William Godwin, who was Mary Shelley's father, and possibly to Mary Shelley herself, had restarted, if you like, or revivified a sailor who had been in a coma for 2 or 3 weeks. And this was concerned to be a great resurrection at the time. And I think the experiments of Aldini, because he conducted a massively well-publicized experiment in London, with an executed criminal. His experiments, the experiments of Klein, the experiments which were being carried out by the Royal Society, had influenced Mary Shelley in the writing of Frankenstein. And so Frankenstein is very much a child of its time.
Interesting. And by the way, your illustrations are as frightening as the stories in the book.
That was Ian Daniels. Ian and I have worked together for about 10 books. I've done 10 books for New Page, and bar one, I think Ian has illustrated every one. So I know Ian. Ian lives in England, and I ring him from time to time and say, we have a new book on, and he says, well, what do you think? And he sends me backwards and forwards stuff and says, we discuss.
Well, he does a great job, Bob. We're going to come back in just a moment and get into artificially created creatures. What inspired you to write a book about that? We'll be back with our special guest tonight, Bob Curran, as we talk about man-made monsters. Final hour tonight, we'll take some of your phone calls and perhaps your stories of creatures that may be lurking around your house. We'll be back with Bob in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, Bob, you didn't just wake up one day and say, I'm going to write a story in a book about man-made monsters. How did you get into this?
Well, George, part of the idea came from the fact that I've written a number of books about folklore, about superstition. And as I said at the top of the interview, one of the things which I wanted to do and which I'd thought about doing was a new challenge, beginning to look at how folklore and superstition merged with science. And we had talked about the time of Mary Shelley when the transition was going on. One of the other impetus to do it was that as I grew up, I became fascinated by some of the old black and white films of Frankenstein. I'd already read the book, and some of the old black and white starring Boris Karloff as Frankenstein, and these used to be on late on a Saturday night. And I, as a young man growing up, I suppose was allowed to sit up and watch these. And it became interesting to me. And I said, you know, what is behind this as I grew up? And so it seemed just opposite to do the thing about the transition between science and superstition, and also indulge some of my boyhood fantasies and interests. So whenever you, Paige, said it's time to write a new book, I said, well, what about things about making monsters? Because it had interested me. And so they said, go ahead. And I kept throwing them ideas, and they kept saying, look, we only have 200 pages. So the result is what you see in front of you. So that was how the book came about. And that was why they published it.
Now, why would people through the ages try to create artificially created creatures?
Why? Well, an interesting question. In most cultures, the creation of life comes about through a supreme being, and include the Christian culture and the Jewish culture among those that these are made. But I think a fundamental question lies at the heart of the man-made monsters, and that is, two questions. One is, what would it be like if we could create life ourselves for whatever purpose? And we can come back to the definition of what we mean by life. What would it be like if we could create life ourselves? And the second question is, and what would it be like? Would it be as perfect as that created by, let's say, the Supreme Creator? The notion which seems to emerge was that it was not, that no matter how well man made life, it would not be as perfect as that created by a supernatural being. And that gives us the idea of the monster. So the idea of creating life is very fundamental. That we want to be as good as God or Jehovah or the Supreme Being. But we are very frightened by it because we don't know what we would create. So we are both fascinated and repelled by the idea. Because if we create something, who knows where it will go? And that is the basis of most of the religion, let's say the religious thinking. And that has been the basis of the religious thinking down through the ages. Because many of the early people who worked at that, for instance, the ancient alchemists working in chemical, trying to grow man or grow people from, let's say, a seed like a plant, had to work in secret because the church said, this is not the way we should be going. This is taking away from God or the Supreme Being, and this is blasphemy. And so many of the ancient alchemists and many of the ancient inventors, and I'm thinking of some of those who worked in with ancient mechanical things, like they produced some wonderful mechanical creations. And one of those I'm thinking of is Jacques de Vacanson in France. And the church told him to stop. He had originally trained as a priest, and this was at the beginning, around about the middle of the 1700s. And he had invited cardinals whom he had known to come and look at some of his works, and they were outraged. So many of these had to work in secret. So there was a fascination by them, but he always had to work within strict parameters, and you often had to work in secret. So we are both repelled and fascinated by the idea of the creation of life, but we don't know where it's going.
Why does it seem, Bob, that with these creations, whether they're myths or real, they always seem to be an abomination? They just don't seem to work right.
Well, I think it comes back to our interpretation of the world. And we talked earlier in the interview, George, about metaphors for things. For instance, if we create life, we are usurping what the Supreme Being might do. We are challenging the very interpretation. It becomes a metaphor for rebellion, if you like. It can become a metaphor for other things. One of the things which we can maybe talk about slightly later is that the golem became almost a metaphor for anti-Semitism. But it becomes a metaphor for a challenge to the order, and therefore it cannot be perfect. It is a monster. It is against the natural order of things. It is against nature. It is against God or the Supreme Being, and therefore it becomes the metaphor for rebellion, for man getting too big for his boots, if you like. It becomes a frightening thing. Even if we dress it up in sort of grand clothes, if you like, you can say this is for the basic good. And we have that idea with, let's say, the robot. We say we're creating the robot to give us more free time, to free up a lot of our time.
Right.
And or the computer. The computer will do a lot of our thinking for us, and we will have more free time to enjoy ourselves and to read and to do whatever we want. But on the obverse side of that, then what happens if the robot runs amok or begins to develop in a way in which we don't want, or the computer turns against us and turns us into slaves rather than they being slaves themselves? And that is the basis of much science fiction and stuff where the robots take over, and you're thinking of iRobot, you're thinking of the Terminator, you're thinking of things like that. And these are the nightmares which are in the back of our head, because these things are a double-edged sword. You also have clones. You can, as I say, these things are still with us. And in the cloning, you can argue that you're doing these things for good, that you're providing cloned animals for meat. You are providing cloned animals which may give us milk with health-giving ingredients. You can have GM crops which will feed the world. The starving in the world, we can argue, but there is always the obverse side, and we bring that in because what we're doing is actually challenging nature. You can say, where does the cloning stop? do we begin to look at cloning humans? And we do know that there are sort of scientific principles in a place for determining the color of your baby's hair, determining the color of your baby's eyes. But where does that stop? Do you give birth to a genius who can then turn against you and rule the world, if you like? And that has been the basis of science fiction as well. Or do you create a super soldier? And there are stories that that is actually happening, so that some sort of new warrior will be produced which can fight in places like Afghanistan, and places like that. So, but what happens if he or she or whatever runs amok? Do we want an army of almost unstoppable soldiers?
They're even thinking of putting in kill switches in these things.
They're talking about that, and they're talking about the soldiers. And I was looking at some some alleged research for this book. One of the things that in the 1990s we fought America, Britain, NATO fought in Bosnia Herzegovina and during some very fierce winter conditions. Soldiers were then swapped to the searing heat of Iraq and Afghanistan. So what was suggested was that you had a soldier who could adapt to any environment into which he was dropped, because this extremes created problems for soldiers. So you have a soldier who can adapt. What would happen if you had a soldier who could not feel pain, if his brain was chemically changed so that he would not feel pain, and he could go into any conflict without any fear of pain or destruction? And what would happen if you could begin to manipulate his thoughts through a microchip, which could be inserted into his brain? And that would prevent him from querying what was happening. If you're fighting in Afghanistan and you say, why am I here? You don't want military don't want him thinking these thoughts. So what would happen if you could insert a microchip which would make him think along certain lines and make him obey along certain lines? And the thoughts which you give him, he would think were the thoughts which he had naturally. So you're beginning to think of very, very frightening soldiers. And that is part of the problem. We are creating a monster for, let's say, defense. And it's you're saying this is necessary to defend America. This is necessary to defend Britain. But there's also the obverse side, in which you could create a monster which could turn against you.
There is an overtone in what you write about these creatures, about spirituality and religion here. They seem to cross over. Tell me more.
Well, I wouldn't come from Northern Ireland, George, if religion did not play a big part. As religion plays a lot in Northern Ireland, but there is a spirituality in the notion of the man-made monsters, because what you're doing is challenge, and we come back again to the fact that we're challenging accepted orthodoxy. Because people have said, look, where did we come from? We were created, and we were created solely. We are special. We are different from, let's say, the animals around us. In the Bible, it says that God has given man dominion over the animals. So we're different. We're better than that. But what happens, and I've mentioned this before, what happens if we create life ourselves? We are actually challenging that accepted orthodoxy. We are now making ourselves even more special, if you like. We are now on equivalent with a supreme being, or whatever you envisage that supreme being to be. We are now assuming the role of gods, if you like, ourselves. And that brings in an element of spirituality. Because if we can create life, what else can we do? And it brings in an element of religion, and that was why the church was so terrified about some of the alleged experiments, and some of the experiments indeed which the mechanical beings which were created, because the church argued that they were almost too perfect. For instance, automatons which were produced in 18th century France were, it is said, almost indistinguishable from human beings. For instance, De Vicosco's, the flute player, was thought to pass for an ordinary human being, and this actually terrified the church because it was very, very perfect. The church argued that it was too perfect. So people became frightened that there were that this was an outright assault on sort of status quo and the accepted religious wisdom. It also challenged the power of the church, because if men could set themselves up to create life, they were actually undermining what the church taught. And was there any need then for the church? If men were as good as gods, what need did we have for a church or a religious system? That's one of the things which the spirituality comes in under.
Do you believe that eventually these man-made monsters will turn on us?
That is always the fear. As I said, the creation of life is always a double-edged sword and has always been viewed as a double-edged sword. They can defend us, and there are stories and legends about men who were created, or creatures which were created to defend. For example, the great man of brass, which defended the island of Crete, Thalos. Now, Thalos was a massive giant created out of bronze who was powered, it is said, by a black blood, which sounds almost like oil. And he patrolled the coasts of Crete and defended against invaders. The black oil could be released through a stopper in his heel. And if you've seen the old films of Jason and the Argonauts, you'll see a representation of Thalos in it. This has been a double-edged sword. We could build defensive mechanisms which could then be turned against us, or destroyed, or in some way. But that is always the fear. The creation of life, or apparent life, is always the double-edged sword. It can become too powerful. A sort of good example of that is the golem.
Yeah, let's talk about the golem when we come back. That's a fascinating subject all by itself, Bob. Our guest tonight, Dr. Bob Curran, Man-Made Monsters on Coast to Coast AM.